that list is be kind, be caring, be patient, be forgiving, be positive, be present, walk in the other person's shoes.
All right, back at it here at Future Proof, episode number 138. I'm Bill Sheridan. I've been here for all of them. Welcome back, by the way. Glad you're here. How are things? Everything good? Everything going well? Feeling good? I'm feeling good. I'm feeling actually great right about now. It's April. It's spring. You know, all the stuff is blooming out there. All that cool-looking spring stuff, right? Flowers, trees, grass. It's all looking great. And I'm not even a spring guy by nature. Allergies, you know. That's my deal. I got a lot of allergies, so I'm pretty much dreading spring in general every year. But early spring, you know, when everything seems to come back to life after a long winter, it's cliche, but I love it. It's rejuvenating, you know? Just kind of makes me feel good. You know what else makes me feel good? Being able to tell you that this week's sponsor is the Business Learning Institute. Ooh, smooth transition there, right? The Business Learning Institute, which delivers competency-based curriculum, courses, content, and community to maximize career trajectories and grow intellectual capital for organizational and executive leadership. Hundreds of courses, dozens of instructors, and unlimited customization. Find out how the Business Learning Institute can help you by visiting blionline.org. So Tom Peters is my guest this week. I might as well just come right out and say it. You know, Tom Peters. Yes, that Tom Peters. Co-author of In Search of Excellence, maybe the greatest business book of all time, and no joking around with that, it very well might be. Author of 17 other best-selling books, business and consulting rock star. He's equal parts expert and student of great leadership and business excellence. I mean, you know, you know who he is, right? He's Tom freaking Peters, for God's sakes, and he's here this week. With me, with you, on this show, exciting stuff. Tom has a new book out. It's called Excellence Now, Extreme Humanism. He actually claims it's his final book, the very last one, his swan song, so to speak. In the afterword of the book, he says, quote, "This book is, in effect, my memoir. It is solely devoted to the things that I care deeply, very deeply about. The ideas are not complex. They require no mastery of calculus or chemistry or physics, but the practice thereof is honored in the breach more often than not. Collecting and sharing these ideas are my life's work and indeed my life." Hence his use of the word memoir there. And the book is brilliant, as usual, and terribly, terribly important, as usual. I mean, look, okay, here's what makes Tom Peters' work so important, in my view. So a lot, and I mean a lot, of the conversations we have on this show have exponential change at their core, right? Exponentially advancing technologies, like artificial intelligence and machine learning and robotics and blockchain, Moore's law and the advent of, you know, quantum computing of all things, right? All of those things and the impacts they're having not only on our profession, but on the wide world around us and what the implications are for those changes. And there's been reams and reams of research that's been done on the skills we're going to need to master to become future ready in that type of environment, right? To be able to thrive in this changing and complex world. And most of that research points to what I think is kind of a surprising paradox, right? As technology kind of reshapes the world around us, those future ready skills are decidedly human skills. They're competencies that bring us closer to one another, that help us lead others and communicate with greater clarity and help us build meaningful relationships and networks and collaborate. Future-ready skills are, in fact, human skills, as it turns out. And Tom Peters has been saying that for years, really decades when you come right down to it. And this new book, it's a curation of sorts. He's curated, brilliant insights from scores of leaders that he's interviewed over the years. And those insights all point to that same conclusion. People must come first, always. Here's just a few of the thoughts that he's collected from some of the world's most renowned leaders. Peter Pronovost, he ran Johns Hopkins Intensive Care Unit. He said this, he said, quote, "When I was in medical school, I spent hundreds of hours looking into a microscope, a skill I never needed to know or ever use. Yet I didn't have a single class that taught me communication or teamwork skills, something I need every day that I walk into a hospital," end quote. And by the way, sound familiar, accounting and finance pros? It ought to. Virgin Group founder Richard Branson, he's famous for saying, quote, "Train people well enough so that they can leave, treat them well enough so that they don't want to," end quote. And Branson, he also said this, quote, he said, "Business has to give people enriching, rewarding lives or it's simply not worth doing," end quote. This one's from customer service expert and best-selling business author John DeJulius. He says, quote, "What employees experience, your customers will. Your customers will never be any happier than your employees," end quote. And then there's this from thought leader and best-selling author Matthew Kelly. He says, quote, "An organization can only become the best version of itself to the extent that the people who drive that organization are striving to become better versions of themselves. Our employees are our first customers and our most important customers," end quote. And finally, this gem from Tom Peters himself. He says, quote, "Take care of people. Train them and train them and treat them with kindness and respect and help them prepare for tomorrow. Insist that every employee commit to encouraging growth and caring for their mates. This goes double or triple in today's troubled times. The goal is extreme employee engagement. The bottom line is to make excellence the norm in all people matters," end quote. I could do this all night long, folks. I mean, you get the point. People first, always. And Tom Peters makes that point over and over and over again in his newest book. Please, please, please do yourself a favor and read it. Really great stuff in there, just brilliant stuff. But it's truly a privilege, really, to sit down with Tom this week and let him tell you some of the stories that drive that people first point home. And that's what we're going to do this week. Tom and I were spending some kind of quality time together here as this pandemic rolls on, talking about things like joy, right? And compassion and caring and kindness and patience and positivity, right? Stuff that, you know, everyone else calls them soft skills. And it's really stuff that Tom Peters himself says are really, really hard skills. And they're the ones that we need to master because they're the skills that will pay off in the biggest way in the long run. So just a terrific conversation this week with one of the most passionate, most respected, most renowned leadership experts in the world. And if this is really his last hurrah, as he says in the book, maybe one of the last chances we're going to get to hear him in this environment. So really looking forward to this. Here is my conversation with Tom Peters. Tom, what's the last year been like for you? I mean, it's been crazy for everybody else. How about life in the life of Tom Peters?
Nowhere nearly as crazy as the families where both members were employed and three kids were at home and an elderly mother was in an independent home. Absolutely had nothing to do with it whatsoever. And also, I have my own little company, but it's not a place where I go to work every day. I was also not transported from face-to-face to three Zoom meetings a day, 8 days a week. So on those dimensions, things, I don't have the perspective of an awful lot of people, let's put it that way.
Right.
The other side of the coin, and I don't mean to make light of this at all, but we went, I'm 78. I've had both of my vaccinations and gone 2 weeks past the second one. We went to a friend's house last weekend and I shook hands with him. Mm-hmm. It was, I mean, it's absurd. It was literally the first time, you know, we'd done this, done that.
Yeah.
But the first time, and I said to him afterwards, I said, oh my God, I can't believe we just did that. And so, you know, that's been, there's a dog barking in the back, but I think that gives us a little more reality. I want to talk about that reality in a minute, but we'll come back to that. Professionally, my wife is a community activist, blah, 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 but she's also a tapestry weaver by her original trade. Mm-hmm. And when all this got going, she started, because friends were and so on, doing masks. And she had done that for a little while. And I was sitting around, or maybe I was talking to my colleague, Shelley, who's without the visuals on with us right now. And I said, wait, well, you have a bit of a reputation and you're sitting at home on your ass and your wife is sewing stuff and let's get it together. And I felt like it was incredibly arrogant, but I'm a bit known for talking about leadership. And so we volunteered to do podcasts. We ended up doing about 35 on leadership in the times of COVID. Mm-hmm. And A, as we're doing and have done, I enjoy the conversations per se, but, you know, was hoping it would be a little bit useful to people. And there's some evidence that it didn't hurt and it may have helped a little bit. So that was kind of my quote unquote contribution. And then obviously, I guess at some level, in a way, the most important thing, disoriented every day for the last 12 and a half months.
As we all have been, yeah.
Yeah. And then the other thing with this business of having a little bit of going out and even more disoriented by my not being so disoriented anymore. Right. It's like, somebody's coming over. I mean, I can really go to the grocery store because we don't have any eggs. And I also found a little bit that I just had a hard time talking to human beings who were in my presence, even though I'd done a lot of what you and I are doing, which is talk itself. So
it's weird how the things that we're going to have to get used to again. I mean, I've got my first shot. I'm still waiting for my second one, which comes in a couple of weeks. So my wife and I have already started talking about, well, we can start doing this and this and things that we just haven't done in months and months and months. And you know, the whole world is going to take some getting used to again.
Well, and there were some things that were really special that we would never have done. We have two kids and grandkids in Colorado, and we're on the south coast of Massachusetts. And in the middle of all this, we drove to Colorado to see the kids. And it was a four-day camping trip that was actually incredibly fun, and we enjoyed it. And the kids had all done their COVID-19 tests, and we had done our COVID tests, and so we lived relatively close to one another for about 5 days, and we would never have done that. And my wife does not particularly like short days, even though she lived in Vermont for 40 years. And so just a couple of weeks ago, we decided that we needed to do something about short days and cold weather. And so we went to Florida for 2 weeks and we drove to Florida, which we had never done before. So, you know, the whole thing is rather flabbergasting. I don't know what word you want to use, but it's different.
It's been an interesting time. And
I do want to say one thing, if I'm allowed to pontificate for a second. In the middle of all these podcasts, somewhere along the way, and you and I don't have enough time for me to really give you the origins, which are quite interesting, I came up with what I called the COVID-19 Leadership 7.
Okay.
And that list is: be kind, be caring, be patient, be forgiving, be positive, be present, walk in the other person's shoes. And I think those are good ideas in general, but you know, I said to somebody, look, here's the deal. I'm managing a regular group of people, and this might sound outrageous, but I mean it to be true. And we have gone back via Zoom to something like a regular work day, and we have Zoom meetings maybe a couple times a day, whatever it is. And you're an important part of this group of 20. And over the last 3 months, you haven't missed a single meeting, and you haven't been late. And so I, Tom Peters, who's the boss, is going to have a sit down with you. And I'm going to say, I'm going to give you black marks for having always been on time. Because look, because I know your story. You've got two young kids. Your wife is working. Your father is, you know, has Parkinson's. And I expect you to miss meetings. I expect you to be late. Please feel free to put productivity, maybe not at the bottom of your list, but at the middle of the list. And on 15 minutes notice, bow out of a meeting, even though I've said this is an important meeting. And, right. And I'm serious about that, you know, because a lot of people, and sometimes because financially they don't believe they can have the liberty of being at all in trouble, or just because they were, you know, like me and grew up Presbyterian, and so you're required to go to meetings on time. And they need to, it's not they need to learn to relax, that's total crap. They need to feel okay about performing in a way that normally would never cross their mind.
Sure. Well, I mean, there was a great example of that. And I think you referred to it in your Twitter feed. A CEO just recently announced that she was requiring her team to no longer take Zoom meetings on Fridays for that very reason.
And urging them to take vacations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And incidentally, it was the woman who is the new chief executive officer of Citigroup. And, mm-hmm. you know, it wasn't Joe and Harry's Bar and Grill, even though Joe and Harry's Bar and Grill employs more of us collectively than the Citicorps of the world.
Right, right.
And I thought that was fabulous.
That's great. And which brings me right back to, I mean, your latest book, Extreme Humanism. Another great opportunity to hear that Tom Peters mantra, you know, people first, which I don't think we can hear enough of. And I was trying to think of a way of moving into this part of the conversation, but then I also on your Twitter feed happened across a post. You were conversing back and forth with some folks about the phrase human resources. And I thought if there's anything that sums up this idea of people first, it might be that. Tell me a little bit about that conversation.
Well, I will, and I can even make a nice little link to the great state of Maryland when I do it. Here's my story about why I don't buy the act of human resources. I grew up near Annapolis, Maryland. I was an only child. I was born on the 7th of November, 1942, at the University of Maryland Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland. I was born at 1:42 a.m. I was an only child. My parents have been trying for quite a while. So my father, an accountant, is allowed into the birthing room at 6 o'clock, and he looks my mother in the eye and says, "Oh, Evelyn, Evelyn, finally we have our own little human resource." He did not say that in any way, shape, or form. You know, if I had it at hand, I would show you my baptismal certificate. It says Thomas Jacob Peters. It does not say human resource. And assets just as bad. You know, I was doing another one of these things. You caught me out with using Twitter a lot. And somebody said something about, yes, you're right. People are our number one asset. And I said bullshit and screamed a whole lot of things that I learned when I was in the Navy years and years ago. I'm Thomas Peters. Look at my driver's license. Look at my Social Security card. I am not an asset. Mm-hmm. And all of this, incidentally, I believe, and it's the subtext or maybe even the primary text of the book, is 10 times more important as artificial intelligence takes over the lives of lawyers, doctors, engineers, and accountants, as much as it took over the world of, for our Maryland friends, the Sparrows Point Bethlehem steel mill 1,000 years ago. And it's not that humanism is the saving grace. But it is. It's human. I mean, there's this term, and I think it's pretty common. I stole it from somewhere. AI versus IA. AI, artificial intelligence, we'll have this program done by two robots relative to you and me, and we're out on the street. And IA, which is the same tools, but it is intelligence augmented. We will use 99.9 or maybe 101% of the power of these tools, but it will be to enhance the human attributes. I want to just take a little sidebar here, which I truly, truly hope that people will listen to. And it's the best definition I've come across of humanism yet. And it's just a little tiny square, okay? Mm-hmm. Radiologists are interpreting the data that came from the CAT scan that I had on my head when I tripped and fell a month ago. Mm-hmm. And I went to the room and the techs gave me my CAT scan, and the radiologist is on the other side of the hospital or the other side of the country or wherever the radiologist is doing the analysis. Mm-hmm. Okay. We do a little trick, and I really hope people will listen carefully to this. Make your own interpretation. I am the radiologist, and I'm now looking at the screen. But now somebody has put a little picture of Tom Peters up in the upper right-hand corner of the screen. Because I'm sitting in that damn room 1,000 miles away, and I have no idea who the hell you are. You're a bunch of ones and zeros. They put a little picture of this guy, Tom Peters. The amount of time that I, the radiologist, spends on the analysis goes up by almost 50%. And as a result of that 50% increase in time, the number of little twitches and tweaks, which are important, which I discover in my interpretive process, go through the roof. And I just love that example because we can put it in a little box and carry it around. It's not about this, it's not about that. It's what it means to introduce a human being into a process. And I don't know about you, but I love that example because it's a perfect picture. And it's also a perfect picture of how little it takes. There's a wonderful book. I never hold up my books during these things, but I do hold up a book. And this one is called Compassionomics. Mm-hmm. And I love it because it's the worst title I've ever heard, which makes it the best title I've ever heard. And it is about the value for the human being, the patient, and for the chief financial officer of the hospital of compassion in the delivery of healthcare. And I know we have a lot of people who are quite numerate who are watching us, but I will guarantee you that I'm pretty damn numerate myself. The authors of this book are, excuse my language, tight-ass researchers. Mm. There is not a single word that's uttered without 17 studies. And one of the ones that's most powerful, but it almost brings you to tears, a doctor is, I won't say to you, we're not gonna infect you. I'm not talking about COVID either. A doctor is talking to me. Mm-hmm. About a cancerous result to some test, okay? Mm-hmm. If that doctor, who was chosen for medical school because he was good at chemistry and sent into a hospital that's now run by MBAs, I have one of those, if that doctor has, we have a number here, ladies and gentlemen, and they did 10 studies, this is the magic number that came out, 37 seconds of eye-to-eye contact, my hospital stay goes down significantly. My complications go down. I mean, this stuff is got hard-nosed, hard-boiled, bottom-line impact. And so we make people better. We save the hospital a ludicrous amount of money, and so on. And there, you know, there are 100 studies like that that are, as I said, the reason I love the title, which is an awful title, is if you call something compassionomics, and I know who our viewers are to some extent, then the damned accountants have to read it.
Right.
And I say, incidentally, let me make it entirely clear because I know who our audience is. You may think I'm a philosophy major who graduated from a liberal arts school somewhere. I have 2 engineering degrees from Cornell University and 2 business degrees, including a PhD from Stanford. So whoever the hell the quantiest person is watching us right now, baby, I can go toe to toe with you.
You speak that language, yeah.
Yeah. my grandfather, who lived near Richmond, Virginia, was in the textile business. And I mean, unbelievable stuff. I've heard that it's, my grandfather could write on a chalkboard seven numbers, and they would be at the level of $4,316.18. Seven numbers, look at them, and give you the total. I mean, Jesus, but I got that. You know, I'm not mathematical, because mathematics becomes art at a high level, but I am numerate to the point, and I'm not really bragging, I'm laughing hilariously. If I got a 799 on my math SATs, I would go and tears would pop out of my eyes. Now, we won't talk about what my English SATs were. We'll leave that behind for a moment.
There you go. Well, and while we're talking about these people skills, English among them and other things, what strikes me about what you were talking about earlier, intelligence augmented. When we're in this era, we're, you know, all this new technology flying around us, and people start talking about the new skills that we're going to need to succeed, the talk always comes back to these human related skills, at least in my mind, that things that bring us closer to one another. And I mean, it struck me at first as kind of a very interesting paradox in a very high tech time, that the skills that we're going to need to thrive going forward are ones that are more human to human. And I don't know if that's still a paradox now or not, but it strikes me as really interesting.
I'd like to say two things, particularly to let us say, and presumably that's part of the group we're talking to an accountant who has her own 9-person firm, okay? Mm-hmm. That's not abnormal with our group that are watching, presumably.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. When you hire people, and I know that accountancy suggests numbers, hire first and foremost for empathy. Mm-hmm. There is a person quoted, and I would ask our colleagues to listen carefully to my language here, who runs a biotech company. It's called Optinos. His name is Peter Miller. He said in an interview, I only hire nice people because it's the only way to maintain our culture. But that's not the important point. The important point is the next point. He said, look, I'm hunting for some job. I want to fill a research job. He said, you know, let me assure you, you and almost not me can't even pronounce the name of the biotech degree we're talking about. Mm-hmm. It is so obscure and sophisticated. But he said, I don't care how sophisticated it is. Guess what? There are a lot of people out there who have that degree. Don't hire the jerks.
Right.
And so this notion, I mean, first of all, which is important to the people I'm talking with, is as applicable to code writing, accountancy, research and development in a biotech company as it is to a housekeeping department in a hotel. And I really think that hire something nice. It's really tough. So you're Mr. Miller, and you're interviewing me as a candidate, and my technical skills are unbelievable. You are literally on the other side of the table drooling. Well, fine, but once we finish this interview, I have to do what he and they call run the gauntlet. Mm-hmm. And that means 7 or 8 interviews with another researcher, with a person who just joined the finance department 2 weeks ago, with the receptionist, whomever. And as much as you have fallen in love with me, each of those 7 people has veto power over my hiring. And, you know, so that's key. And then I just have to add this, and I know I'm going over the map here, relative to the people who are watching us in bigger firms. Mm-hmm. And I want to say this and stare at the screen in front of me and wiggle my index finger. the number one source of quality, productivity, and retention. The number one source of that is the quality of your first line supervisor. Mm. Without a shadow of a doubt, whether it's Deloitte and Touche. By the way, I also have a little bit of a little bit of finance on my CV. I worked for, some are old enough to remember this name, Pete Marwick Mitchell and Co. Uh-huh. In Washington, D.C., way back in 1970 after I got out of the Navy. And it was just incidentally, you know, these numbers now that Deloitte and Touche have 80 million people working for them. This was right at the time that the big six, big seven were just getting into the consulting business.
Yeah.
So anyway, and the problem with the first line, Peter Drucker said every promotion decision, including particularly the first managerial position, his language, and he was not given to hyperbole. He was an understated Austrian. Mm. Drucker said promotion decisions are life and death decisions, and particularly to the first line people who have not been in a leadership / managerial slot before. So if I am in a 100-person accountancy or financial services organization, it probably has what, figure 9 first line supervisors or something like that. Mm-hmm. The quality of those 9 people is the single most significant success variable that you have in the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can't find somebody to fill the job and you say, oh my God, everybody is really stressed out, let's just give Jake the job. Well, don't.
Right.
You know, leave it vacant for another 4 months if you have to, and people will have to accept the pain, but don't just throw Jake in because he's the oldest one while we try to find somebody good.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that important. And that notion of hiring nice people first. I mean, you know, it strikes me, you've alluded to this in numerous books, that goes the other way too. Leaders. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned it just a couple of minutes ago, those 7 characteristics of leadership in this era. You know, caring, kindness, all of those things. It flows back. I love the fact that in the intro to your book, you mentioned Richard Sheridan. From Joy Inc. I had the pleasure of speaking to him here about what he does. And we did it on Zoom. So he took the call in his office, which is nothing but glass walls, by the way.
Yeah.
So he's looking at a screen, and behind him, I'm looking out onto the floor of Menlo and just seeing not only people walking back and forth, because there are no walls, but there are dogs walking back and forth. I think that there's a baby, like a playpen in there. I mean, this is the culture that he's built. Is all around, well, in his words, joy, but it's serving his people.
Yeah.
Which, you know, people, it's just clearly obvious that here's a company that puts their people first, and it's probably obvious, but I mean, what lessons do you see at Menlo that the rest of us ought to be paying attention to?
Well, the first lesson, which is again appropriate to this conversation, we're talking about a high-end industrial software company. We are not talking about a hotel. We are not talking about a restaurant. This is, you know, quant world, tech world. So this is not about the quote unquote soft industries. You know, right. Let's make that clear. Well, it sounds so outrageously hyperbolic. And I think I said this in the book, and I know I said it when I was writing something recently. The most important day of my 40-year professional life was the day that the co-author of In Search of Excellence, Bob Waterman, and I ventured from San Francisco down to Palo Alto to talk with the president of Hewlett-Packard, John Young. And we were doing the research for what became the book. And somewhere along the way, John introduced us to the HP Way. And the HP Way, the centerpiece of which was MBWA, Managing by Wandering Around. And I didn't know it at the time, but I said, you know, in retrospect, when he uttered those 4 words, my life changed, because I was used to dealing with the Citicorps and the Chase Manhattans. I was working at McKinsey and Company, the old McKinsey and Company before the Marls left. And I was used to that formality. For God's sakes, I worked on the 48th floor of the 50 floor Bank of America Tower in San Francisco, and the 50th floor was loaded with executive assistants and executive assistants to the executive assistants and antiques that, you know, dated back to, you know, ancient Rome. And leading was not an intimate business. And John made it intimate. And he was an engineer. He was a Hewlett-Packard guy. this is a very different Hewlett Packard than today. They had just crossed the 800 million mark or something like that. They were big, but they were not one of the giants. But, you know, it proved that leading could be, I'll use my term today, people-centered, but it meant that it could be personal and it could be intimate. And after John and Bob Wooderman and I had talked for 45 minutes, and he wasn't putting on a show for us. He was a very straight guy, taking us around and showing us the damn place. We weren't going to buy anything from him. He had no idea whether we'd be in our book, and our book wasn't supposed to sell anyway. And so he said, you know, come on, let's wander around. You know, it wasn't today's company, but it was a billion-dollar company, which is not exactly six people in a garage. And so we go into the engineering spaces and we go around and chat with engineers. I swear to God, if he didn't know all of their names, he knew 90% of their names. Mm-hmm. And no, they didn't entirely talk about the Oakland Raiders or the San Francisco 49ers since we were in Palo Alto. But it wasn't down to business stuff. It was about, you know, kind of this and that and so on. And they were exactly the conversation that you and I are having now, which I would call thoroughly professional and incredibly personal, you know, and he did that. And, you know, he was Mr. Big. He was the president, albeit the president of a billion-dollar company who worked in an 8x8 cubicle that had walls that only came up to my nose, which also, as I said, wasn't exactly the 50th floor of the Bank of America building in San Francisco. Right. And so that MBWA was, it was a life changer. You know, it really... I mean, you know, I do also want to say, since Maryland's a big part of the viewing audience, my mother was a Virginian, and I know there was motherly love, but the number one thing she gave me was good Southern manners. I have a lot of problem with some of the things that go on in the South, Georgia's voting rights stuff and so on, but she gave me Southern manners, and with all due respect to our colleagues, you know, I've got so damn many math courses behind me, it would sink a small ship. The manners are more important than the math. Yeah. Manners beat math. You alluded to this before. I gave a speech. As I said, I'm a Cornell graduate. And I was invited to give a lecture at Cornell. And I don't know where my head was at the time. It was 10 years ago. And so I said, look, guys, I'm sorry. I'm a Cornell engineer. I think in equations. And my equation of the morning is K equal sign R equal sign P. Kindness equals repeat business equals profit. And, you know, it is, you do the kindness because you had my mother, because you're a decent human being and you care about your fellow human beings. But per the compassionomics point about the little picture in the upper right hand corner, the damn stuff works.
Right.
You know, it goes right through to the bottom line. And one other thing I want to say to our financial people here, one of my big things is design. And Apple's former design chief, Johnny Ive, said, we only design, he said, I know this sounds arrogant, but we want our products to make a little contribution to humanity. Now, the reason I'm using that example in this conversation is the beauty in the artistic nature of an Apple computer applies as much to a financial report or a training course as it does to Apple computer.
Sure.
This design first thing applies to every unit in the organization, HR, finance, product development. I don't care any of them. You know, I worked for McKinsey, as I said, for 7 years, and I had a guy, Gene Zelazny, and Gene was the guy who taught McKinsey people how to make good presentations. And I'm still carrying it with me. You know, he said, none of these three-dimensional crap when you're putting something on a graph. You know, two dimensions, clear what the relationship of the variables are, understandable to a 9-year-old. And he taught us clarity, and it was McKinsey. And so we were always dealing with numbers, but he taught us beauty in a presentation to the 25 people who were at the top of Wells Fargo or Bank America or Citicorp. And so, and this is really important to our friends who are in accounting. I have a friend here, and we have a Sunday walking group. And one of my Sunday walking group mates spent most of his life at the CIA. He is a physicist, and he was responsible for taking the crappy pictures that came out of the belly of an SR-71 or a U-2 and turning them into imagery that could be read so we could see whether the bad guys had missiles or not. Right. And he said, you know, I don't remember what he and I got talking about, but he said, you know, I had this mate, and he said he had absolutely the best team. He said, I couldn't figure it out. And he told me one time, he said, oh, so I never have a team that doesn't have a musician on it.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And it's really important because my wife is an artist. I am an engineer. Mm-hmm. I dropped out of architecture school at Cornell, which I matriculated in because I didn't have one damned iota of artistic talent. And my headmaster at my Annapolis school, it said, Evelyn, that's my mother's name, you know, he really wasn't built for architecture school, so we'll send him to an architecture school in a place that has a good engineering school. And so from architecture to civil engineering, I went at the end of the first semester. But beauty in a financial document, supported by an artist or a musician who looks at the world in a totally different way, that's good stuff. So I say to all of our friends who are in little financial services organizations, hire a musician this year, hire a theater major, hire an artist, but surround yourself with people. I don't even begin to know what I don't know relative to an artistic perspective. A good friend of mine is an artist, and I have a little piece of his that's hanging in our house, and I was looking at it the other day because I was going to see him, and I said to him when I saw him, I said, Jesus, Bill, I love that picture, and I am just stunned that one of my fellow human beings could create something that wonderful. Yeah. You know, again, to me, if you, you know, we probably don't have that many people who are watching us, despite the nature of the group who used wooden slide rules.
Right.
But
that
to me, life begins and ends with a wooden slide rule.
Yeah, right. You start bringing in that other type of perspective and it changes the game completely. It's
really, really does. You know, and you know, one of the things I focus on a lot is more women in senior positions. And, you know, I could spend the next hour and a half ranting about that, but there's a woman who wrote a Silicon Valley book, and I lived in Silicon Valley for 30 years. It's a horrible book. It was called Brotopia, and it was about the just horrible culture. You know, they invented Me Too Cubed long before the movement started. But she said, and this was particularly when Facebook was getting into trouble, she said, the nature of Facebook algorithms would have been different if 30% of their code writers had been women.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like the musician thing and the artist thing, just a different disposition, not softer or any of those variables, which I hate, but just looking at the world. I mean, you know, women and the genetics tell us this are more about human to human contact than we boys are, which to me is very Darwinian. What the hell were boys invented for? To run around in the jungle throwing spears at wild animals, right, while the women took care of the community and protected it and so on.
All the hard work. Yep. I wanted to just ask you real quick. You mentioned in your book, this is your last hurrah, you're calling it. And by the way, is that true? Is this your last book? Is this it for you?
That's my plan.
Yeah. Yep.
I am 78. And I remember one time 25 years ago, I don't remember when he passed away, watching Peter Drucker on a screen lecturing to a group that I was going to lecture to, and he was 91. And I turned to somebody and I said, I hope to God that I am not still going to be giving presentations at the age of 91.
Yeah.
You know, and there you go. That's the way I feel. And I also, you know, a whole lot of people, because I've had a lot of blind luck and stuff is turned out pretty darn well for me, say you should write a memoir. And this book is a memoir.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I've spent the first research for In Search of Excellence started in 1978. So for 43 years, I've been chasing this set of ideas around. And so my adult life is about these ideas. Mm-hmm. And so I really, you know, have taken the gloves off and really, you know, people always say I'm a screamer and a shouter, which I also got from my mother, but that's a different story when we have more time. But you know, this is my best shot and my last shot. And I really do want to say, relative to you and this time that we've had together and the group that you work with, this is as good as it gets for me. Because people in financial services, people in accountancy, you're my people. My father was an accountant. I was trained in finance, third order differential equations. And I really want to be mean and nasty and say all of these so-called soft things I'm writing about are well within the grasp of anybody trained in accounting. Mm-hmm. And they all apply, from the artistic nature of the presentations you make to what have you, to this whole idea of extreme humanism. I don't want to hear any crap from accountants that it doesn't work for us.
Right.
Because it does. Now, I do want to say one thing, however, too, and I don't suspect I will get any challenge from this from our viewers and friends. One of my good friends in Silicon Valley days was the inventor of one of the first spreadsheets. And he and I were, I think, having a third glass of Chardonnay somewhere in Palo Alto. And he said, "Do you know what my contribution to humanity is with my spreadsheet, Tom?" And I said, "I have no idea." He said, "I've really helped a lot of really stupid people look smart." It's a cheeky little remark, but everybody who is watching us knows precisely what I'm talking about.
I'm sure they do, without a doubt. Oh, my God.
And that, I assure you again, is said with love and affection to my fellow quant peers, not as the art major who came in to lecture to me.
And for all their clients as well. Well, that's a great note to end on. Tom Peters, thanks. Not only for the conversation, really, but for, you know, almost half a year of wisdom. I really feel like we're better off because of it and because of you. So thanks for all you do. And thanks for being here. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for the invitation to talk about the things that I really, really, really care about. And I would just add one point, which is nothing other than a reinforcement. I do have all those damn degrees. But I think I said it in print. If you want to understand what I'm talking about, you must show me a signed certificate of graduation from the fourth grade.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this ain't higher math, my friends and colleagues. This is stuff that fourth grade certificate will do the job, and you will be able to get 97.5% minimum of what I'm talking about.
What was that book came out a few years ago? Everything I learned in kindergarten or something like that.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yep. That's a great point. Well, Tom, thank you.
It's been my pleasure. I love this stuff, and we've talked before, and with any luck, we'll talk again. And I love to be able to talk about it and hope that it makes sense, have it make sense to everybody, but I would like it to lead to some action by a couple of people who say, "Oh my God." You know, and if there's anything I want anybody to remember out of this time together, it's that little teeny picture in the upper right hand corner that when the radiologist looked at it, he didn't know. He didn't know he was spending 50% more time than normal. But just the fact that he was looking at a whole bunch of numbers that had to do with a photograph of you or me, in my case, since I had one of these, led to hugely, hugely altered outcomes.
People first.
People first.
Amazing, amazing stuff there from the one and only Tom Peters. The website is tompeters.com. Please don't forget to follow him on Twitter. He's at Tom_Peters. The man works Twitter like a master, folks. He holds like complete conversations there, for God's sakes, and about important stuff too. So follow him there. That book again, maybe the final book of his illustrious career. It's called Excellence Now, Extreme Humanism. Order it, read it, live it. Fantastic stuff. And by the way, pretty much all of Tom's written and speech material from the last nearly 20 years or so is available free to download at tompeters.com and excellencenow.com. So there's really no excuse not to learn from this guy. It was just great sitting down and talking with him this week. And don't forget, this week's sponsor is The Business Learning Institute, the BLI's Future Ready Learning Framework, outlines the skills like caring and compassion and collaboration and all those things that Tom Peters and I were talking about this week, the skills that CPAs need to thrive in the rapidly changing world of accounting and finance. That framework is all about gaining and maintaining deep technical knowledge along with a strategic skill set. And here we're talking about strategic aptitudes that have been identified as most crucial for tomorrow's CPA. Start mastering these future-ready skills now by visiting macpa.org/future-learning-framework. Whew, and that's all I got, gang. Have a great week. We will talk to you again soon.